on page 3.
So yay us for coming out on such a wet, soggy day. So first, a brief recap, very brief. This month, as most of you know, we're studying Dogen, and specifically a fascicle he wrote called Continuous Practice. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Dogen, he was a Japanese founder of our particular sect of Zen, which is known as Soto Zen. He lived in the 1300s. And even though this guy lived only to be 53, he left behind a remarkable number of writings. So when I first heard the term continuing practice, my mind immediately went to Theravadin practice, which was the first practice that I started with as a Buddhist practitioner. Theravada Buddhism is an older school of Buddhism, sometimes referred to as a school of the elders. Vipassana is a Theravadin practice. Because of their approach to practice and the discipline and focus that they bring to it, they develop deep states of concentration, which are necessary in that practice to realize insights. I was taught to use noting or labeling during meditation. And when I spent an extended amount of time in a Burmese monastery, we used noting in all activities of life, in all the noble postures of sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. So silently saying, rising, falling, while following the breath at the belly, and then thinking when a thought arose, and anger when that emotion made an appearance. And likewise, when not meditating, every movement, sight, and sound was noted. The goal there is concentration, which is necessary to experience insights. The abbot in the Burmese monastery at the time was Sado Upandita, a somewhat fierce and intimidating figure who would exhort us to pierce the object, the breath, with our mindfulness. The guy really frightened me. As you may or may not know, the goal of the school of Buddhism, at least as I understood it, was to transcend this world of suffering, to leap off the wheel of samsara. So the idea is that you practice in a very focused way and obtain a very strong level of concentration and have various insights. It's a step-by-step process. Then you eventually have your first glimpse of or experience of enlightenment, which is called stream entry. It's a very methodical step-by-step process. You can actually refer to a text called the Visuddhimagga, where you can actually identify where you are in this process, what stage you are at. This is such a different way to the way we practice in Zen, where Zazen is sometimes described as purposeless sitting. Sitting with no goal. Also, we practice to free all beings. It's not just about me getting off the wheel and entering a place of bliss and happiness, although that does sound really appealing. In our practice, we don't just practice for ourselves, we practice for all beings. This is a radical idea, a radical proposition. And it's not about getting off the wheel of samsara, this miserable place where we all suffer. It's really about helping everyone else, which includes ourselves, come to a place of deep understanding, deep realization. As aspiring bodhisattvas, we vow not to attain Buddhahood until all beings do so as well. So as Zen practitioners, when we talk about continuing practice, we are including so much more in practice. We are including the whole world. Another aspect that I find really inspiring, and it's also central to our Mahayana practice. We pay homage to and include our Buddha ancestors, beginning with Buddha and the ones in India, China, and Japan in our practice. And when we practice, it's like we are affirming their practice, their lives. We are connecting to our Buddha ancestors and the Buddha himself. This is a quote by the Dogen scholar Stephen Hine from his book called Dogen, Japan's Original Zen Teacher. Dogen consistently emphasized that practice does not make or transform human beings into Buddhas. Instead, practicing the Dharma expresses or reveals one's enlightened nature or manifests the dynamic activity of spiritual illumination. Therefore, it must be understood it is not we, as calculative selves, who perform practice. It is the Buddhas we already are that is practicing through each of us as an appropriate vessel. So that was Stephen Hine. Also, without us practicing, there would be no Buddha. There would be no Buddha ancestors. When we sit Zazen, we are the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. I actually sat under that tree in Bodh Gaya. I was in India in 1998 doing, and I was doing a Buddhist pilgrimage with two nun friends. And one of the places, of course, we went to was Bodh Gaya. And it's amazing because I don't know what it's like now, but there's this tree. It's actually the grandchild of the original tree. There's no fence, no barricade, no lineups. So the three of us just sat there, meditated, hung out in the place where Buddha gained enlightenment. Amazing when I think about that time. And I wonder what it's like now. Through our practice, we are also connecting ourselves to our future descendants. We are ancestors ourselves to those future people who will one day practice Zazen. Between our ancestors and our descendants, our Zen practice both includes and transcends time and space. And Dogen is famous for his writings on time and space. So how can I relate continuous practice to life and death, which is basically the subject of my talk? There is a fascicle by Dogen called Zenki, which is translated as undivided activity. What does that mean? Well, if we look at the word Zenki, Zen in this case, which is not the Zen we usually mean, means total, complete, or whole. And ki means dynamic, working, or functioning. So Zenki becomes undivided activity or complete activity or full and total movement of reality. And this was actually how Norman Fisher specifically translated the word Zenki. And this idea of undivided activity points to a radical transformation of our life as taught by the Buddha. And it has to be every moment, every breath, every activity. After all, our conditioning and habitual tendencies are so strong. It's being fully present for our lives as much as possible. And of course, when we are doing more intensive practice, say during a multi-day session, it's easier to be aware of our physical activities and mind states on a continuous and moment-to-moment basis. So being continually present in our lives is one thing, but how does death fit into this? Well, death is the magic ingredient of impermanence. Everything is always arising and passing away. We are born, arise, and then we pass away, death. Every flower, plant, tree arises, grows, then after a certain length of time, dies and is gone. Each moment arises and passes away. Although we usually think of ourselves being born, living, then dying, we often forget that all things are impermanent. Arising, maybe existing for some time, then dying or passing away. Going back to Vipassana, when I practiced that particular practice, we were encouraged to really watch carefully for the arising and passing away of all phenomena, especially during sitting meditation, every breath, every thought, every emotion. When you see this happen over and over again with everything that you can possibly experience with the senses, you appreciate deeply that everything is being born and dying every moment. We also do this in Zazen by being aware of what is present or arising and letting it go. So we can see that death is a very necessary ingredient of life. So this is from Dogen's Zenki, or Undivided Activity, fascicle. The great way of all Buddhas thoroughly practiced is emancipation and realization. Emancipation means that in life, you are emancipated from life, and in death, you're emancipated from death. Thus, there is detachment from life and death, and penetration of life and death. Such is the complete practice of the great way. There is letting go of life and death, and vitalizing life and death. Such is a thorough practice of the great way. Realization is life. Life is realization. At the time of realization, there is nothing but life totally actualized, nothing but death totally actualized. Dear Dogen, let me take a stab at this. I think what Dogen is saying is that when we practice carefully and conscientiously, we see impermanence so deeply and clearly that we aren't caught up in the drama of our life. There is a kind of detachment. Detachment here means not attached to or not holding on to anything. We don't cling so much because we appreciate that there's nothing to hold on to. Everything arises, then passes away. Everything. But at the same time, there is penetration of your life, meaning you are fully alive to your life. You really appreciate it. And so it's not such a problem. If you really appreciate your life, you are less likely to have problems. This is from Soka Gakkai, which is a Japanese Buddhist movement based on the teachings of the 13th century Japanese priest Nichiren. From the Buddhist perspective, life and death are two phases of a continuum. Life does not begin at birth, nor end at death. Everything in the universe, from invisible microbes in the air we breathe to great swirling galaxies, passes through these phases. Our individual lives are part of this great cosmic rhythm. Claire mentioned in her talk last week that Dogen referred to our practice as a circle. As Dogen states, your continuous practice creates the circle of the way. And I was thinking of how that cycle of life and death, or birth and death, can be easily seen as cyclical, continuous practice. Life, death, life, death, etc. I've always thought that if we really practice as if we might die at any moment, I mean, really live from that perspective, we would have a very different life because we would have a deep appreciation for this life and want to be present for every moment. The puny problems we think we have would fall away and we would focus on what was important in our lives, including being deeply present. When my dad died, it was a profound experience. Up to that point, I had not had anyone close to me die. There was tremendous grief, but also an appreciation that I had such deep feelings because I love my dad so much. I always felt we had a strong heart connection. It really did feel bittersweet. I remember at that time being out grocery shopping and feeling deeply offended that people were just going about their day and even smiling and laughing. My dad had just died, but the world continued on as if nothing had happened. The other thing that I felt and thought at that time was how I wanted to make my life count. I didn't want to waste it. I guess this event of my father's death really brought out the preciousness of life. And now I see that it was an unspoken vow to myself. And even though I seemingly have forgotten about that vow, that thought, I believe that it did change my life in subtle and unseeable ways. Death has got to be the ultimate teacher of impermanence. Dogen talked about Ichi Daiji, which means the one great matter. This one great matter is life and death. And by realizing this matter deeply, we can be free. Another aspect of death was exemplified in this passage of Thich Nhat Hanh from his book, No Death, No Fear. The day my mother died, I wrote in my journal, "A serious misfortune of my life has arrived. I suffered for more than 1 year after the passing away of my mother. But one night, in the highlands of Vietnam, I was sleeping in the hut in my hermitage. I dreamed of my mother. I saw myself sitting with her, and we were having a wonderful talk. She looked young and beautiful, her hair flowing down. It was so pleasant to sit there and talk to her as if she had never died. When I woke up, it was about 2 a.m, and I felt very strongly that I had never lost my mother. The impression that my mother was still with me was very clear. I understood then that the idea of having lost my mother was just an idea. It was obvious in that moment that my mother is always alive in me. I opened the door and went outside. The entire hillside was bathed in moonlight. It was a hill covered with tea plants, and my hut was set behind the temple halfway up. Walking slowly in the moonlight through the rows of tea plants, I noticed my mother was still with me. She was the moonlight caressing me as she had done so often, very tender, very sweet. Wonderful. Each time my feet touched the earth, I knew my mother was there with me. I knew this body was not mine alone, but a living continuation of my mother and my father and my grandparents and great-grandparents, of all my ancestors. These feet that I saw as my feet were actually our feet. Together, my mother and I were leaving footprints in the damp soil. From that moment on, the idea that I had lost my mother no longer existed. All I had to do was look at the palm of my hand, feel the breeze on my face or the earth under my feet to remember that my mother is always with me, available at any time. I said everything dies, but it is also true that nothing dies. And in the passage I just read, Thich Nhat Hanh realized this, expresses it, and the idea that in death, we just shift form. Here's another excerpt from Dogen's fascicle on Zenki. Life is just like riding in a boat. You raise the sails and you steer. Although you maneuver the sail and the pole, the boat gives you a ride, and without the boat, you couldn't ride. But you ride in the boat, and your riding makes the boat what it is. At just such a moment, there is nothing but the world of the boat. The sky, the water, and the shore are all the boat's world, which is not the same as a world that is not the boat's. Thus you make life what it is. You make life your life. When you ride in a boat, your body, mind, and environs together are the undivided activity of the boat. Thus, life is nothing but you. You are nothing but life. Dogen seemed to like boat metaphors, which he used to illustrate how reality works. We think we have control of our lives, that our plans and ambitions will work out the way we want them to. But as we find out, this is not the truth of it. We don't have complete control. The relationship ends, we get diagnosed with cancer, our job ends, we get older, and our body starts to fall apart. So living our life from the perspective that we have control is a bad strategy. The opposite of thinking we have control of our lives or what happens in them is to feel the opposite, that we are victims of our life, that no matter what we do, it will not make a difference, and it, or life, always works against us. I have to admit that it's easy to feel this way in a world where so many, many negative things are happening. Climate change, wars, seemingly increasing poverty and homelessness, to name a few. But this isn't helpful either. We need to have faith in our life, or in this example, the boat that will carry us where we need to go. Norman Fisher gave talks on this fascicle undivided activity at Loon Lake in 2018. Funny thing, I was there, but I have absolutely no recollection that he talked on this subject. Anyway, this is what Norman said about this particular passage. We are operating this boat of our lives. No matter what we do, even if we think we are doing nothing, we are actively operating this boat of our lives. So our choices, our commitments, and our efforts absolutely matter and will prove fruitful, but not in the small bore way we were taught. Our life matters far more than we ever thought it did. Our lives matter absolutely, not only to us, but to life itself. So we have, as human beings, an overwhelming and tremendous responsibility. And we have no worries and no pressure at all, because this boat is going to pull us along no matter what. It's the boat that takes us where we need to go. Not us. So we do our part. We make effort. But there's no sweat, because the boat will pull us. We can completely trust the boat and the ocean, not to fulfill our preferences and needs, no, probably not, but to fulfill our destiny. And the boat isn't just a boat like some other thing. The boat also is your whole body and mind, of all the beings, the earth and the sky. So that was Norman. Also included in the boat metaphor is a concept of interdependence. The boat needs water to function as a boat. The person in the boat steers with the rudder and sail. The sky is present and is active when supplying wind to the sail and light. And without land, a boat has no real meaning. So all these factors are interdependent and go together to make up this situation of a person sailing in a boat. Life is also like this. As I'm writing this, and this is when I was writing this, there is a couch that I'm sitting on in a house that I'm sitting in, the atmosphere around me, the iPad that I'm typing into, the hum of the heating system. All these things go together to make up that particular moment. It reminded me of Thich Nhat Hanh's explanation of interdependence. When you look at a piece of paper deeply, you can see the tree that was felled to make the paper, the rain and the sun that helped the tree grow, the logger that cut down the tree, the logger's parents, what the logger had for breakfast, on and on. And if you take away any of those elements, there is no piece of paper in front of you. Everything and every situation is like this, made up of many constituents that go together to make the thing, paper, or the situation, a boat sailing on the water. I've had the good fortune of kayaking on the ocean. And when you're in a kayak, you're very low in the water. There is a feeling of being part of the water. There's the water, the sky, and if you're very far from land, the sky is really big. You're surrounded by sea and sky. And then there is the activity, the arms moving the paddle, propelling the kayak through the water. Just paddling is an opportunity for continuous practice and undivided activity, being with the water and sky and just paddling. I want to express my gratitude to Ehe Dogen for his teachings, and specifically for these fascicles on continuous practice and also undivided activity. Through these teachings, he is encouraging us to pay attention, to not waste our life, to be fully present, because it is through our practice and activity that we realize the truth. So thank you, Ehe Dogen, and thank you, Norman. And to end this talk, I will recite a poem by Joe Brainard. I had printed it out, and it's that copy is now on my coffee table at home on the Sunshine Coast. So there I was in a coffee shop this morning, copying it out for my iPhone. So it's called Death, but it's on the lighthearted side. Death is a funny thing. Most people are afraid of it, and yet they don't even know what it is. Perhaps we can clear this up. What is death? Death is it. That's it. Finished. Finito. Over and out. No more. Death is many different things to many different people. I think it is safe to say, however, that most people don't like it. Why? Because they are afraid of it. Why are they afraid of it? Because they don't understand it. I think that the best way to try to understand death is to think about it a lot. Try to come to terms with it. Try to really understand it. Give it a chance. Sometimes it helps if we try to visualize things. Try to visualize, for example, someone sneaking up behind your back and hitting you over the head with a giant hammer. Some people prefer to think of death as a more spiritual thing, when the soul somehow separates itself from the mess and goes on living forever somewhere else, heaven and hell being the most traditional choices. Death has a very black reputation, but actually to die is a perfectly normal thing to do. And it's so wholesome, being a very important part of nature's big picture. Trees die, don't they? And flowers? I think it's always nice to know that you are not alone, even in death. Let's think about ants for a minute. Millions of ants die every day, and do we care? No. And I'm sure that ants feel the same way about us. But suppose, just suppose that we didn't have to die. That wouldn't be so great either. If a 90-year-old man can hardly stand up, can you imagine what it would be like to be 500 years old? Another comforting thought about death is that 80 years or so after you die, nobody who knew you will still be alive to miss you. And after you're dead, you won't even know it. Thanks for listening.
Page 3, chant after Dharma talk.